Welcome to the Modern Romantic Podcast, everybody, where we celebrate romanticism in the modern age by featuring passionate people and the amazing things they do. Today, we have the pleasure of chatting with Alisa Quitney, an Eisner-nominated known author for her captivating work in graphic novels, romantic fiction, and urban fantasy. With a background as an editor at DC Comics and Vertigo, please welcome Alisa Quitney to our podcast. Yay!
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. It's been a little while since we had to reschedule, but I'm so glad we got to and that you're here.
I am too. It's kind of exciting because, as you pointed out, my career kind of had two branches for a while, one which was in comics and one which was in novels. And I think more and more the audiences are overlapping. So it's since the I'm doing more comics these days, it's comics being what I call graphic novels because I'm old school. Right. It's really nice to be talking romance and comics.
Yeah, sorry, I needed water.
Comics, romance, and water. Just the necessities of life.
Well, I feel like your background in comics has, and your background in editing and things like that have really, it's gone hand in hand. So how do you think that has influenced your approach to crafting these stories?
Oh, you mean how is editing impacted how I write?
Yeah, like working as an editor. I mean, obviously, it's like you had an insider scoop first.
I think that one of the best advantages of editing was that I got to speak to so many different writers, and I got to really watch how they worked, because it's one thing to craft a story and it's another to watch people who are crafting stories month after month on deadline. And how do you do that? And, you know, so I had wonderful writers I was working with, among them Neil Gaiman. And so I think that was really important. And then switching back and forth between writing and editing, because even when I was on staff, I was still doing some writing and being edited, made it more comfortable. I think as an editor, I can instantly recognize what isn't working, and I can often figure out a way to work back into it. And as a writer, I am far more clueless for far longer.
With your experience and working across various forms of literature, could you elaborate on how different mediums like comics and prose and graphic novels shape your storytelling techniques?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I should say, for people who are not as familiar with comics or graphic novels, which are just, you know, it refers to the length of the thing. They might think, well, what did I edit? Did I just edit the little words in the caption box or in the word balloon? And comics, a lot of comics, the comics I worked on, were written full script. And so the script would specify a lot of what went on, or most of what went on in the art, as well as the captions and the word balloons and the sound effects. And so what I was editing were the scripts.
Okay.
And there's comics, you know, especially if the writer and the artist or the artists are not the same human, there's a lot of collaboration that goes on. And, you know, some people love collaboration and thrive on it. Some people want it to be completely their enchilada and no one else should sprinkle any cheese on it. I think that, first of all, I began to love collaboration because I had already gone through Columbia's MFA program and written my thesis, which turned into my first novel, when I started working at DC. So I came to DC not knowing a lot about art, but thinking I knew a lot about writing. And I think working really reshaped a lot of it, because I began to see how the dance of collaboration can really enhance a lot of things, especially, you know, when there's a nice, there's a Hebrew term, gibush, that speaks to the knitting together of a team. And if there's a nice gibush, you know, synergy between the artist and the writer and the colorist, you know, the whole team, that's really incredible. I started out really, you know, writing. I think dialogue came naturally to me. I could hear banter in my head and I could make banter happen. And my earliest novel, Till the Fat Lady Sings, was very influenced by Fay Weldon, who was a comedy of manners, social satirist, but not an intensely visual writer. And I was not an intensely visual writer. And then coming to work in comics, you can look at my prose novels and absolutely see the before and after of working in comics, because the next book I wrote, The Dominant Blonde, which was sort of a caper that was packaged as chiclet, is so much more visual and so much more filled with action and weird scenes. There's a corpse that goes from place to place. It is a romance, but there's also a lot of strange humor and a corpse, and my weirdness tends to shine through.
We love it though.
Thank you. Well, so there, the visual component, because I had to learn it like a second language, I've ended up teaching it a lot. I love teaching visual storytelling, and I just keep trying to learn more. I mean, I Jenny Cruzy, who was on your show, was another mentor of mine. And then I began to look at what she was doing, and then Nora Ephron, and then I realized, oh, wait a second, Nora Ephron was completely, inspired by Billy Wilder, the writer director. And Billy Wilder was really into Ernst Lubitsch. And so I comics got me thinking a lot about all the people who made sausage of different kinds and how to learn it and break it apart. And I'm sorry, I'm babbling on, but I learned
No.
more from comics than I probably learned from my MFA in the long run.
That's pretty awesome though. And I love that perspective too. It's very different and I suppose gives you an edge as well. One thing you mentioned about collaboration had me thinking of other art forms like for instance, I do photography and I do some glass fusion and things like that. And I'm wondering like what a collaboration looks like to me. Can it, at least in photography, has always worked out for the most part. But in some other art forms, there would be potentially some egos involved. And I'm wondering, like, obviously, some of these collaborations have worked out for like phenomenal good in your world. Because, I mean, look at the obvious and awesome successes you've seen. But like, how does that work? I mean, do you see a lot of that? Like, I mean, because that's a lot of compromise, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I've taught comic book writing, and one of the first things that I usually start with, what kind of how salty can my language
But
be? Because I have two
you can
versions.
be
I
yourself.
can salt it. All right, so when I'm teaching children or young teenagers comic book writing, I say, you know, if you're mainly a writer and you're writing for an artist, you have to remember that the artist is not just there to be, you know, your functionary and draw exactly what you're telling them. They're there to contribute as well. And the more you engage with them creatively, the better the work will be. And when I'm, you know, teaching adults, I just say, the artist is not your bitch. So I think that sometimes people want to completely dictate and over-direct the artist. And you know, and they'll say the character should be turned 3/4 of an inch, and we are 6 feet away. And they're trying to give every. And what I learned, especially from reading Neil Gaiman's Sandman scripts, was sometimes he was describing to the artist things that can't be seen, but which would inform the work. So he would say, I can't remember verbatim, even though I've got a podcast on the Sandman right now, you would think I would remember these things. But for me, I will say something like, you know, we may not have seen this character before, but this is more confident than he has ever been before in his life. And the artist just knows what it looks like when someone who is sort of nebbishy is suddenly having a moment of bravery. And I try to compare this to people who are new to the forum as if this is ballroom dancing. And if you're the writer, you're the guy ballroom dancing. The artist is the one in the fancy dress that everyone is looking at. So, and if you can't enjoy that, if you can't dance with that, then this is not really going to be the medium for you unless you yourself learn to draw. I've been working for about, oh God, is it 5 years or longer with Maurice, who's been my artist on a number of projects lately. And I think the thing that really made a difference with him is he delighted in the collaboration. He wanted to talk about things, and we developed a real trust so that, you know, I was listening to how Jenny and Bob Mayer talked, and it's kind of like that with Maurice and myself, because to get humor into a comic, so much is about, it's not just the back and forth banter, but it's the timing of the reaction, you know, it's being acted and how many panels and how many slices of time you've, you know, all of that is going to affect whether the joke lands. And then I want more than a joke. I want to be able, you know, my goal is something like Fleabag, where you go from moments of humor that soften you up for the emotional sucker punch. I'm borrowing Phoebe Waller-Bridge's language there. I'm paraphrasing, but mm-hmm. I think she has put that wonderfully. Mm-hmm. So it's only through not having ego and saying it's, you know, how I wrote it or how you want to draw it is not as important as what works for the story.
Right. I guess if everybody has the same focus and end goal, and it makes a good team, because that matters, certainly. One question from our chat is, do you ever have to adjust your art style on collaborative projects, or do you get creative freedom? And it could be you answered that.
So, I mean, in the past, I've usually been paired with an artist, and often it will depend on the project. With Maurice, I know he is always sort of, he has a very European style, but sometimes he's been a little more mainstream, you know, American DC Comics. He did Harley Quinn stuff. And with Guilt, he was going very realistic, very detailed. And then he, you know, he's doing something a little different for the project we're working on now, which is set in Greenwich Village of the 1950s. But now I myself don't draw. I draw only well enough to kind of sometimes, you know, I will give an artist a picture that shows in a really awkward way what I'm trying to get at. So, and in terms of adapting my writing style for a project, I think one always does some adaptation. You know, I've written YA in prose, and I've written comics that are more YA and some that are more adult. And you know, I get weirder or less weird depending on the project.
And you've seen some success since you were young. You were published at 8, is that right?
Oh gosh, yeah. I was the poems and stories that were published when I was 8 were written, I think, about a year or so earlier. Wow. But yeah, I was the Teachers and Writers Collaborative was then operating in New York City's public schools. And I was a really weird kid, and my mom was a poet and a journalist, and my father was a science fiction writer. And so, you know, my mom was introducing me to the idea of free verse and blank verse really early on. So I was writing poems. and they collected them in a book. And that was so exciting that it instantly gave me writer's block. So
Wow.
I didn't write again for a few years, I think.
I mean, that's kind of a lot for an 8-year-old, though. I mean, exciting, yes, but wow. I mean, that I don't know what I would have done if I'd been published at 8. But yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't feel like a real writer because I didn't think poetry was real writing. I thought real writing was books, lots and lots of words in them. And now I always try and read some poetry before I'm writing because it's such a incredible way to hone your language.
Yeah. Right. Do you feel like experiences like that, being published at 8, did that influence your creativity later or maybe your resilience?
Oh, probably. I think, I think I had to discover again and again that I didn't quite know what I was doing. I know that in, so I was an undergraduate at Wesleyan, and I was writing weird science fiction-y stories, and I couldn't get into any of the writing classes until finally I got into Kit Reed's writing class, and she is a great science fiction, maybe even horror writer, mainly science fiction. So she mentored me there. But then when I applied for Columbia's MFA program, I kept thinking about the writer I was supposed to be. I think I kept relearning the same lesson, which is it is okay to be yourself. But I'm probably still learning it now. I think I'm constantly thinking, I should write a book like so and so wrote. That was successful, and I think I could do that. And then I write it, and it's much weirder.
You said that you're weird or that your writing is weird several times now, and it's interesting because you also say that you should be yourself. Like you should
Yes.
embrace that. And so I'm wondering, like, you're calling yourself weird, but like, no, it might be weird, but like, obviously your audience is enjoying that. We're enjoying that. I'm enjoying it right now. So it's not
Oh.
weird to me. I mean, maybe it's a little eccentric or eclectic, or maybe there's a better word to describe it, but I'm all about embracing the weird. So that weird isn't a word that I see as being a negative. I just wanted you to know that.
I'm glad. Well, I know that, for example, I wrote werewolf romances before werewolf romance became such a big thing. And they didn't get published until after werewolf romance became a big thing. But there were tropes of werewolf romance. One of the things was sort of fated to be mated. And mine was different. I had a woman whose husband cheats on her, and he gets lycanthropy as an STI and gives it to her.
Oh, wow.
And so he's not, spoiler alert, he's not the real love interest. And this, I think it went against so many of the tropes of romance, werewolf romance, honestly, good taste. But I really enjoyed it because I love the idea of the Jekyll and Hyde aspect of lycanthropy, of werewolfness as, your intuitive self telling you the things that your rational self refuses to acknowledge.
I want to know if this poor wife who got lycanthropy, if she knew it existed.
Before, no, she was just a veterinarian who was smart
Oh
about
my.
dogs and stupid about men
All of a
until she
sudden she
became a werewolf and had more. Well, the inspiration for that book, I don't know why I'm talking about this, but it's a good example of
Yeah.
weirdness. I was at the Mohonk Mountain House, which is this beautiful turn of the century hotel that really looks so much like The Shining that it's shocking to think that it's not where The Shining was filmed. And it got me thinking about The Shining and how unfair it is that in The Shining, the husband is, you know, given supernatural strength and taken over by the ghosts of the place, but the wife is just on her own. And I was thinking, this is unfair. The wife should definitely have, you know, supernatural, you know, she should have her supernatural team just as he has, and they can work out their marital differences in a, you know, pitched supernatural battle. So that was my inspiration.
Yeah. I love it. I want to read this now because I haven't. And I'm imagining the idea of having bizarre symptoms and not knowing what in the world, what is happening to me. So that's great. Tell me the name of that one.
Okay. Oh, so there's two actually. Those were written as Elisa Sheckley. Okay. I used my father's last name. My father was the science fiction writer, Robert Sheckley. And the books are The Better to Hold You and Moonburn.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, in the chat. I know a few people who would like to read this book too. Yes. And back when we were talking about poetry, one question was, do you gravitate to any specific poets for inspiration?
Yeah, so let's see. Lately, because of the 50s, I've been rereading Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, particularly what's the poem that Anne Sexton wrote about the frog teacher, the frog, you know.
Oh, well, I'm
burly, sorcery, wise. So anyway, there's that. Theodore Ruthke, The Waking. I was just revisiting. I did a podcast for my Endless podcast that I do with Lonnie Diane Rich, and we were talking about the Song of Orpheus. So I went back, and there's the Rilke, what is it, Orpheus, Eurydice, Hermes, I think is the name of that section of the poem.
Yeah, Trey, who is unfortunately ill today and couldn't be here, is really well-versed in Eurydice. He has a really cool video on his YouTube channel that is the story of Eurydice, and he reads it so well because Trey does voice acting. And I'm plugging Trey. He's not here tonight, but go listen to his Orphe Tunes is his YouTube channel, and you should go and listen to Eurydice. And you're welcome for the plug, Trey. He would do that for me. In fact, minimally, he deserves that. So,
I'll check it out. Definitely.
Yeah, it's fabulous. Anyway, you were talking poetry.
I think that's everything that's jumping into my mind right now.
Okay.
Yehuda Amichai.
Okay. Not familiar, but
he is a great agnostic poem. I just remember, like, my head, your hand, something like, I did not curse and dream of a paradise of a thousand stroking hands on heads. He's a lovely, funny, philosophical poet.
I have to check that out. Say the name again.
Yehuda Amichai.
Okay.
Amichai.
Okay. So I wanted to talk about, sorry, my headphones just fell off the desk. I was like, what?
Well, that's all right. I was worried it would be me.
No, we're fine. Real life happens.
I took a drink of water and managed not to choke. I have to tell you, usually when I take a drink of water, and I took a little speech and language prerequisite, so I know that, you know, the price we pay for speaking is that we can't drink and breathe at the same time after infancy. But I am particularly bad at breathing and drinking.
Breathing and drinking. Yes, I will. In fact, I'm going to wait because I will end up not being able to speak as well. So. I wanted to ask you about editing too, because you mentioned Neil Gaiman, and I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but what was that experience like working with him?
Just terrible. No,
Yeah,
I'm
I imagine
joking.
it would
We
just
are
be horrific.
we
Which
are
is why
still
I asked.
friends. No,
Sorry.
we're still friends. I had the enviable task of interviewing him at the Woodstock Book Fest this past April, and I got to be, I don't know what to call it, book doula on the Norse mythology book that he did a few years back. He was very smart, and he knew all the different aspects of things. So I remember being, he was only a few years older than me, and I mean, we were young, but he already knew so much about how he wanted the art to look and the covers and even the promotional materials. He had opinions and good ones about all the surrounding aspects. But he was also really just fun to talk to, because he was this reader, and I think there's our one of our stories is that at some point he was talking about science fiction writers that he had admired. And I said, "Have you read the writer Robert Sheckley?" And Neil said, "Yes, God, his short stories from the 50s into the early 60s were brilliant. And then I don't know what happened. The work after that kind of fell apart. I think maybe it was drugs." And I said, "He was my father." And Neil said, "Oh God, I," and I said, "No, it's okay. I completely agree with you."
That's
So.
hilarious. That's great. What a great trap. What a great trap.
Beware all who talk to me.
And now you have this wonderful memory that you'll never forget. That's great. I can relate. I remember when I started at a new high school with my sister, and we were only there a couple of weeks, and there was a girl in the parking lot who, I mean, I didn't know anybody really yet. And she was bad mouthing this new girl. And she was just saying horrible things about this new girl. And being new, I didn't know who else was new, really. And so as I walked up and I'm hearing this, someone else goes, "You need to be quiet now," to this girl. And her name was Tracy, we'll just say that. And Tracy was like, "What? Why?" And they're like, "That's Emily's sister." And I went, "What? You've been talking about my sister that way?" Yeah, so I've had a similar. Tracy, we're gonna have some words. Tracy, if you're out there, I remember.
Get her.
It has been long forgiven, but yeah, that's.
And I said, "Get her," in a completely facetious manner.
Of
If anyone
course.
knows who this Tracy is, do not get her.
Do
That
not
was
get
not
her.
really meant.
No, it
Do
would take
not.
quite a feat for someone to, or anyone who would be listening from high school. Plus, how many Tracys were there then? Right. When you are like fueled and inspired to produce any kind of creative output, I'm wondering, this is a question I'm asking our guests lately because I'm really interested in this myself. When you fuel yourself or when you're inspired by something, do you do this intentionally or do you kind of just n notice that it just happens? And is it better or different?
Oh, interesting. What do you mean exactly by fueling? Do you mean like the original idea, like that moment when you say, "Behold, this is a viable idea," or do you mean in the nourishing and planting of it, how you fuel yourself?
The nourishing and planting, like some artists might go look at the works or read the works or listen to the works, depending on their art form, of others. Some people just like to go walk in nature. Some people are fueled by a comfort food or, like whatever fuels you or inspires you. Do you seek that out intentionally?
Absolutely. Seek it out intentionally. And I also teach writing, and so much of when I'm teaching, I'm trying to create mini assignments that can be layered onto, onto themselves. So I and they all start out as tricks for myself. So for example, one of my tricks will be to say, I'm a set designer today, and I'm going to think about the main sets where things are taking place if I'm doing a novel, and think about what are the elements in this bedroom or apartment that tell us about this person. And I'll just have that be a mini assignment. I do all the things. I know some people play music. When I was just in September, I was doing some co-writing with Neil, and he always said, "What kind of music do you want me to put on?" I say, "Oh, you choose." And he would pick music with lyrics, and I was thinking, I don't want to disturb him, but I cannot focus. This there somebody is singing about, something, and I can't hear the, words in my head.
Right.
So I can listen to music when I'm walking and sort of see scenes, but I can't listen while I'm writing. And oh, there's a lot of stuff I do before. I very deliberately watch old science fiction movies these days, and I go back and forth in my head, so I watch these B science fiction movies from the 1950s, which is definitely a part of what I'm writing. But then I also think about the real psychological underpinnings of what I'm writing, because I think lately a lot of what I'm writing toggles back and forth between science fiction tropes, romance tropes, and then my always trying to remember what it is I'm really writing about so that I kind of keep it grounded.
Sure. Right. Also, because you have a more modern tone, so like some of the ideas and things maybe from a 50s science fiction film wouldn't be something you would want to necessarily emulate. For instance, like I'm thinking of the role of women in general and things like that.
Oh, but perhaps one is engaging with that
I was thinking. Perhaps.
I mean, one of the things that I felt, my father's short stories, I love reading them. And I should say, my dad didn't raise me. So I was sort of raised by the books he left in his library. Some were his, some were other
Okay.
writers of his cohort, and some were the writers who inspired him. And he wrote really great short stories, but it always seemed to me they were of science fiction worlds where aliens could be essentially human, but women not so much. Women were always more other than the aliens.
Maybe they are. Maybe they are. You never know, right?
I don't know. I was thinking about how the older I get, the less sure I am about gendered, exactly how the genders work. Because, okay, this is my current theory. I was
Okay.
listening to Jenny Kruse and Bob Mayer, and they're talking about how women tell stories and how men tell stories, which of
Yep.
course was Jenny's thesis. And I've been thinking, honestly, I think that after the age of 45 or 50, everything shifts.
Okay.
And I think that men and women become less, and I'm talking cisgender, heterosexual, I think we have become much less dissimilar. We become much less dissimilar.
Okay.
You're not convinced. I also think Splatterhouse
I'm thinking
is a
about it.
horror movie, but we can talk about all these things.
So, what's an example of that to you?
Of how, okay, so I think a lot about when I write romance, and romance, is in almost everything I do because I love romance. I think that it is such a great engine because it motivates people to move out of their comfort zones like nothing else.
Yeah.
But one of the classic, received wisdoms is that what is it that Byron said? Love for a man, 'tis a thing apart, 'tis woman's whole existence. But I think he meant nookie, the stupping, I think he meant, and that men can compartmentalize. And actually, my daughter, who majored in bio, was telling me that actually when women have sex, I guess oxycontin is released every time, and with men, it's only if they already have some emotion connected to the person. I think that's what she said. But I do think that this idea that men have sex without engaging emotions, and again, there is no such thing as men, there is no such thing as women, we are individuals. But as a general rule, I think once you've lived in your body for long enough and past the age of 45, 50, once your body has developed new and exciting ways to humiliate you, I think the idea that most men just completely compartmentalize from sex is at the very least less and less correct.
I would agree with that. Probably. I mean, I'm not a guy, but I imagine.
And somewhere a cat screams
Yeah.
in protest or agreement, it's hard to know.
She's back.
Yeah,
Yes, I'm talking about you. You want to come up here and say
I'm just
hi?
looking to see if anyone said something like, "You're wrong."
You're
All
wrong.
the men I know compartmentalize.
Yeah, I don't. I'm waiting for that. Huckleberry. Huckleberry is my dog, and he is. I don't know where he is. I think he's upstairs. That was in the chat. So, yeah, he makes an appearance once in a while. He's a good boy. Come here. I will show you off real quick so you can be quiet. Otherwise, we love having a good interruption, but. Oh.
Aw.
Turn around. No,
Oh,
nope.
sure.
Okay.
You always get more animal ass than you expect. My dogs often sleep with me, and it's very rare that I have a dog head next to me.
I don't think that buttholes mean the same thing to animals that they do to people.
Thank God, my dogs have big furry tails that I consider them modesty tails.
I wish my dog had a modesty tail. He has the lack of a modesty tail. He is very immodest. I love that. That's great. Yeah. If it's not Huckleberry, it was Velvet. And that's Kaz asked, what is, if that's not Huckleberry? Yeah, it was Velvet. She's tearing around here. That's her thing lately. The moment I sit down and have a podcast where I'm actually recording and speaking to other humans, she wants to be part of it. I can't play with you right now, baby. Anyway.
Well, at least she doesn't have a sonically high-pitched bark like my
Oh.
Icelandic sheepdog.
Yeah, that
Oh,
is.
someone says, "Aw, hello, Velvet."
Yep, there she goes running up the stairs. Velvet says hello in her strange little way.
It's Trey here from the Modern Romantic Podcast. I wanted to take a moment to say thank you so much for listening. Wherever you are listening from, it really means the world to us. Emily and I started this podcast to share inspiring stories and celebrate the many forms that art can take. Having you here along for the ride as we continue that mission really inspires us to keep going. We are constantly blown away by every single listen, so we really mean it. Thank you. Okay, now get back to the interview. This one's good.
You resonate with readers across different genres. And how do you balance these diverse themes? Like your work spans various themes and like fantastical and in graphic novels to like being introspective in romantic fiction. Do you find that I guess, yeah. How do you approach balancing those themes?
Oh, it's a good question. I love humor, and I think I always start out by wanting things to be funny as long as they are true. And to me, to be truly fun. So for a while, my books were being packaged with chiclet. And the problem I had with some chiclet, and it was, first of all, there was great chiclet. And I think a lot of what we now call romantic comedy in novels is basically chiclet under a different name.
Yeah.
Those were the first romances in the 90s where a woman's career was considered really part of her happiness, so that it wasn't just that she was getting the guy, but often she was getting the job or the advancement, and it was often about that aspect as well. But often they were clever but not funny, and they would have what I think of as the joke-shaped object, where it was written in a funny, clever way, but it wasn't funny, because to be funny, you actually have to go someplace a little dangerous. And it's so the classic, I feel so depressed, I just want to sit home with a pint of ice cream and, I don't know, and my fuzzy slippers. Mm-hmm. That's not really exposing anything. If you're, I don't know, if you've got it would have to be more, maybe the first person who wrote about eating an entire pint of ice cream on your own when you're depressed was revealing something, but then it became socially sanctioned, as opposed to, devouring an entire roast chicken that the family was about to eat or whatever. So I think you were talking about how do I balance these different things, that I always try to balance it in part by, figuring out if it's true enough to be funny. And if it can't be funny, then, telling it straight, because I would rather have it be dramatic than a failed funny.
Yeah.
And funny is hard to achieve. And in terms of the weird, I try not to go too far into, I guess, what friends have called the ick factor. I know it depends on the kind of story. I just did a story for Creepshow, and they wanted more horror. So I put in what's called body horror, the term where it's gross as opposed to horrific. Mm-hmm. And I love gross. I think it can get in my way with romance. So in Guilt, my time travel graphic novel that came out, I guess, was it last year already with Morrissey? I wanted the home healthcare aide, who's in her 50s, goes into this apartment and she's looking for Band-Aids. And she ends up pulling out a diaphragm that's covered with cobwebs. And the reason I thought this was really funny is because I know from my daughter and her friends that, the diaphragm is now in the museum of antiquated, birth control methods. And, I guess it's up there with, avocado colored refrigerators and those Corningware percolators with a little glass nipple on top. No one has it anymore.
It also could be a funny, someone's metaphor for maybe their life.
Yes, the cobweb diaphragm. Mm-hmm. But also it was inspired by the true experience of finding some things I wasn't expecting to find looking through my mother's medicine cabinet for other things. So I think it really does depend. Ahoy Comics, who's been publishing me recently, really gives me a lot of leeway to be weird and go for the full cobweb diaphragm. Sometimes I pull it back a little more.
I love that they're treating you well like that. I love that.
But, you know, I also want it to work. I sent you one page.
Yes.
Where there's so.
Should I pull that up?
There are, yeah, you can pull up the page. So there's a clinch in it. And it's, this is a little bit of a spoiler. So this is the home healthcare aide. Mm-hmm. And it's complicated who the guy is, because he is, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but it turns out they knew each other as teenagers, which when basically the home healthcare aide, Trista, and Hildy go back into the past, they go back into 1974 New York City, they discover that they knew each other and have this whole past, and it also involves this guy whom she knew as a teenager. And so, you know, I want things to be funny and sometimes really true, but I want to have the romance moment as well.
Yeah. And he had recognized her, and it didn't matter her age. He would always
say, oh, they're both. Yeah. I mean, they're both the same age. They're both in their 50s in the present timeline.
Right.
And when we go back into the past, I think they're 9 and, well, they're close in age. I think they're 9 and 12.
Okay. But yeah, he would recognize her regardless, because he had like a thing for her then.
Yeah. Then. So through a lot of the comic, you see them as kids. There was a real 70s genre of, you know, free range kids on the city getting into trouble. And so there's that element at play there.
So you called it a clinch. So what, for those who may not quite understand what that is, can you describe that, or at least explain it?
Clinch is the old romance cover where they're embracing and almost kissing. Mm. Usually, actually, can you go back to the panels before? I'll show you as we approach the clinch.
Yeah.
I don't know if we can. So basically, if we go back a little bit more, so there's the first is she's trying to, okay, stop there. So I'll describe this for people listening. So Trista is trying to escape and Wynn is pulling her in, and he pulls her in at first, and he's in uniform. I won't say what uniform yet, but he's got her kind of imprisoned. I mean, not imprisoned, but he's holding her sexily semi-captive there, and they're bantering back and forth, and he's declaring himself and she's resisting. And then let's see, we'll skip down to the next. And and she's pushing him away. And then she pulls him into the embrace. And this was really, I think it's romantic. It's fun, the choreography of a kiss scene. I wanted to have some of that 70s romance play of, you know, a little danger in the power play between the two people. But in the 70s and 80s old school romances, as we know, they were sometimes problematic by today's standards of consent. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to make it very clear that she pushes him away, he lets her go, and then she pulls him in. And so that was also part of the choreography that I worked out with Maurice, the artist.
And
and that's Hildy. Yes. And the, can I read the dialogue there?
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Let's be honest. The fact that I have a position of occult authority totally turns you on. And she says, turns me on? What if your kiss turns me into a dead-eyed night porter or sends me back to the last ice age? I've got zero trust in you. You think that lights my fuse? And he says, yep. So, and I laugh at my own joke. There you go.
No, you should. I love that.
And yeah. I just rewatched All Our Yesterdays, which is the original Star Trek episode that's where Spock goes back to the Ice Age and mm-hmm. becomes a barbaric, you know, much more primitive Vulcan who is overwhelmed by Mariette Hartley's leather bikini.
And Josh said in the chat, Trek nerds, yes. Yes,
Somebody just said to me after rewatching that with me, Alisa, I think that may be the source of a lot of your, romantic imprinting for better and for worse.
It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing at all.
In real life, I don't know. I don't know. Vulcans can be problematic.
Well, yeah.
Okay, so fun and esoteric fact. I just looked this episode up, and it was written by a woman who was, I think, a head librarian at Harvard. And all she wrote was All Our Yesterdays, Jean Lisette Aroesti, Aroeste. I can't pronounce that.
Okay.
And she also wrote the Star Trek episode. As far as I can see, these are the only two things this woman ever wrote. It's the one where there's the alien being in the box, and he's got the woman with the spangly veil that is blind.
Okay.
And also, Spock has a mind meld with the alien and goes mad. There's a lot. She was very into Spock.
Well, it's interesting because we had, I'm trying to remember what he said, but we had Tom Blomqvist on the show. And he talked about how during, because he was a producer and director and stuff, and he was telling us about how people could just basically, it sounded like this. So I could be quoting him completely incorrectly, but and I'm also terribly paraphrasing this, but it was basically like people could just sort of submit what they scripts of what they wanted for these shows, and that they would go through them, and you never knew who was going to end up being able to have a their script as an actual episode of some of these shows. And I find that awesome, but also like I wonder if that's kind of what happened here. Like she didn't write anything else
Yeah, just
that
those
we
two.
know. Except maybe whatever volumes she had in her house that never got released or published or whatever.
It
Fascinating.
does make me sad because I think those were two of my favorite episodes of OG Star Trek.
Yeah, maybe she got really lucky and you never know. Because you teach writing, I was thinking about you must get a lot of people ask you for advice on writing because obviously you teach it. What advice do you give regarding AI? And writing to yourself.
I have not really engaged with it because I think what is interesting to me about story is not how you put together a bunch of tropes. So if you're going to borrow from science fiction and this from romance, and what I want to know is why you're telling that story. Why are you choosing that? What grounds you in that story? And so I don't understand how that is interesting. In the same way as if if AI can put together a bunch of different artists and do something, and it's and I have a friend who told me she's using some AI artwork to generate images of characters, that she can look at when she's writing. I don't, for me, that doesn't work because I think there's something so soulless about it. And I say that maybe in some point in the future I'll see it differently. I am always the very last person to adapt to any technology and the first person to give it up. So I remember that, I was given a Kindle when they were new, and I was just horrified, and I gave it back. And years later, I did sort of, get a Kindle again. But mostly, I read books. I still keep my planner is handwritten. So I guess the main thing about AI is it doesn't interest me. And when I haven't been teaching classrooms of kids, so I don't have this problem right now. But handwriting is really a great way. You engage more of your brain when you're writing and when you're writing cursive. I've also just gotten, Neil loaned me his Free Write, which is a little typewriter that goes click, 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 click.
That's
and
awesome.
Saves to the cloud. So yeah, I'm going in the opposite direction from AI.
From a romanticism standpoint, I embrace that and love it. And I feel like there's still plenty of us out there that are leaning toward real books with spines and paper. I guess my thought was, you know, you said AI is kind of soulless, and definitely for sure, because really all it's doing is taking from humans what's already been created by humans and spitting it back out in, you know, different arrangements. And I guess, outside of the fact that it is mass theft of works written by humans, it is also like, because it's becoming increasingly smart and increasingly like having the ability to have different tones and different things like that, because you can type in something like, I want to write a novel that sounds like a Lisa Kwitney, you know, something like that. So I was just wondering how you were discussing that with your, if you were discussing it with your writing students. But I think nothing will ever replace the human element, and nothing can write a story like we can write a story or tell a story.
Well, the why, I think, will always be missing, unless the AIs develop true consciousness, in which case we're all screwed.
We've seen those movies.
But it's the why that makes things interesting to me. And I also think, you know, there was a period of time, maybe this is too different, but I find Victorians fascinating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a period of time where the best, newest thing was automation, and the Victorians were thrilled to say, this is no nasty handmade jewelry. This was made by machine. Look how perfect it is. And, you know, obviously we don't feel that way. We look at a hand-knitted sweater that's beautifully done, and it seems infinitely better to us, handmade, you know, mm-hmm. just to watch someone doing something and have some of the spontaneity and grain of all of that. So yeah, I don't know. I think humans need to create. It's part of, you know, in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, at some point we need to create things. And I don't see how AI fits into our need to create and connect.
Yeah. That, and I mean, we're at kind of a weird place in AI technology too. So it feels a little premature to say many of the things I feel like saying about it, like what I just did with it can't, I don't believe it can replace humans truly. But I mean, 2 weeks from now, that could be different. So we're in a weird place with it. And I feel like things like the recent SAG-AFTRA strike, where they were talking about how AI can capture someone's image and use it in perpetuity and they'll never get paid another dime, feels very wrong. But it's influencing and affecting many art forms, writing, photography, drawing, painting, all kinds of things. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, it's, you know, ABBA recently had this big show where they had, I guess, their, you know, some kind of simulcrums of each of the Bjorn, Agneta, Frida, and Benny, you know, in their prime. And I had zero interest, even though I've always been a huge ABBA fan, because part of what I loved about ABBA is there was always something a little authentic and awkward about them. You know, the fact that Frida never stopped changing her hairstyle and always, it seemed, for the worse. You know, the fact that Agneta looked increasingly miserable and on the verge of crying, you know, how much she didn't want to be on stage without, you know, being squeezed into those weird Lycra costumes when they really didn't seem like the kind of people who should be. Right. And to take all that away and glossify them, it was as if they'd been turned into a cartoon. I loved the awkward humanity of ABBA. It was a big tangent there, but
yeah, well, that's why we're here. We're here for the tangents. When you are teaching writing, or when you're instructing writing, what are some of the tips that you like to give your students? What are some of your top pieces of advice?
Oh gosh. One of the things that pops into my mind recently was a friend asked me to analyze a scene of hers and tell me, if it was working as well as it could. And I said, okay, and it was set in the French Revolution. And I said, okay, hang on. Let me understand. Let's put two chairs together. So we're in the carriage and there are highwaymen outside and they've been there for a few minutes when the scene begins. Can I see them? How much can I see through the window? And how much do I just know? Am I peering forward? Am I leaning back? How much time has elapsed? And how much time do you think I have left before they come back in? And so we were just starting to put our bodies there and game it out. And I think that sometimes one of the things I do is just talk about using acting techniques or visualization or whatever you can to fully immerse yourself in the reality of the scene. Because otherwise, we're sitting there and writing something that feels pretty far removed and people are just bantering while their lives are at stake. And, I want everything to feel authentic, even if it is, in the end, very stylized. And I think, I'm sure you've had this experience too, where you've seen a movie or read something and you're thinking, that's a lot of banter for people who are about to die. I mean, I know that they're not really going to die, but how do they know?
Right. Right. Or like, why are you run? Why are you still talking?
Yeah.
Stop trying to fumble for your keys. You're not going to get them in time.
So that's one of the things that I talk about. I also talk, lately I talk a lot about having an activity in a scene in order to help you pace it so that the scene doesn't go on longer than seems natural. Okay. If someone's washing dishes while having a conversation, at some point, you got to finish how many dishes were in that sink?
That's a good one. There was a book I read where, I don't really want to give it away, but there was a book I read where the main character took way too many showers, because I guess the main character had to do a lot of thinking, and like I myself can relate, because I do a lot of thinking in the shower. It's one of the best idea places for me. But like, this book was too many showers. It was like, how many showers can someone take in a book before you start to go, all right, come on. And I wondered, like, because it was a
unless
way
they're a teenage boy,
right? That's so valid and accurate, right?
So here, but wait, I had a thought and I think it's just vanished. How embarrassing. Showers, what were we talking about?
We were talking about advice.
Oh, things that are smirking. I want to talk about smirking. There came a point where romances kept having heroes smirk. And I was thinking, has the word smirk, I know language changes, but I always thought of a smirk as an unpleasant smile.
Yeah.
Unless Bruce Willis was doing it in Moonlighting. But other than Bruce Willis, unpleasant on everyone else.
Yeah, it's not.
I mean, if someone smirks at me, I am assuming that they are probably saying something about, maybe your sister, and I don't like them.
Yeah, I guess I saw it as a little bit stuck up, or like looking down upon you. Like I'm smirking at you.
Condescending.
Which is
one of the giveaways that a marriage won't work if somebody is condescending, or I suppose smirks at you.
Smirking. Don't be smirking.
Sorry, writing pet peeve.
Yeah. I never thought about it like that. But yes, you're right. I do see smirk that way. And Now I'm going to be hyper watching for that. Tell me what you're working on right now.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Let's see what I can reveal. So it's set in Greenwich Village in the 1950s. There's definitely a sensual romantic relationship. But there's also elements of science fiction, B-movie, alien tropes. And but it's also partially about my parents who live together as beatniks in the village.
Oh, fun.
So, okay. I can say one other thing. It's got a riff on a real character, Mildred Newman, who was the star therapist who wrote with her husband, How to Be Your Own Best Friend. And I became more and more fascinated by Mildred Newman. Because it turns out if you just do some digging, she was everybody's therapist in Hollywood. Nora Ephron's therapist and Paula Prentice's therapist and Anthony Perkins's therapist. And anyway, it just, the more you dig, the more deliciously weird it gets.
Awesome. Well, we will have to watch for that. So to watch for that, I want to make sure our audience knows how to find you. And also, how can our audience best support you?
Oh, okay. What am I? I'm on Facebook as Alisa Quitney, Alisa, last name Quitney. I have a website. I'm on Instagram at kwitty. And what else? Twitter, I think it's at A Quitney, and Blue Sky, whatever the version of that is. I think I'm Alisa Quitney or something like that on Blue Sky. And I am ambivalent about being on Twitter these days, or X, or, you know.
We still call it Twitter here.
I wish it were.
Yeah.
Who knew that Twitter was its halcyon days? Right. Yeah, I think those are the main places that I am.
And
I've got a podcast with Lonnie Diane Rich, Endless, a Sandman podcast where we read Sandman comics and talk about them and the Netflix series when it comes back.
Can't wait for that. And you can go to alisaquitney.com and find more information as well as other links to her social media. So, yeah, someone said the platform formerly known as Twitter.
Yes.
So the symbol for the platform formerly known as Twitter, I guess, would be an X, but
universal mark for poison.
It would seem. Well, thank you, Alisa, for being with us today and chatting all things comics and writing and your really cool work. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. And I'm sorry I didn't get to meet Trey this time, but heal, Trey, heal.
Well, we'd love to have you back sometime.
Oh, I'd love that. Thank you so much.
Of course. This episode, along with probably every episode in perpetuity, is dedicated in memory of Joe Capone, our moderator, fellow comedian, passionate encourager, and greatly missed friend. You can find us pretty much wherever you tune into podcasts. For updates, announcements, and more, please follow us on social media under Modern Romantic. Thank you, everyone, and don't forget to be yourself. Bye. Hey, it's Emily, the host and creator of the Modern Romantic podcast. I just wanted to let you know of something you may not be aware of, and that is we sometimes reference the chat or an audience during our show, and that's because we record via a live stream. So we actually have a live show on Mondays and the occasional Sunday, and you can tune in too and be part of that live audience. It is via chat through our social media network. So when we're streaming live on Facebook, Twitter, Twitch, Instagram, and YouTube, you can join in the chat and we can see it. And so can our guest, and we can answer your questions and respond to your comments and see everything. You can be part of that community. We'd love for you to be there. So join us sometime. Head to our website to check out our social media links and when we're streaming live. That is www.themodrom.com.